netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source. Be sure to check out our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Today we've got a little bit of a special podcast for you. As many of you know, John Montgomery, Mike Seymour, and myself all started our FX Guide based around our shared love of the software Flame and making our livings on that software at the time. And Autodesk has just released the updates, major updates to Flame and Smoke and Luster and Inferno and Flint and Smoke. There's extension releases, the 20th anniversary edition. There's a whole laundry list of things that have been released this week by Autodesk, and it's a major redesign of the workflow. Really a major revamp of the workflow, really trying to streamline things and bring timeline and batch together in a way that is even more than it's ever been before. So we have a chance, John Montgomery had a chance to sit down and talk with Philippe Soiro, the product manager for Flame, and talk to him about these changes in depth. We talked a little bit about this way back in IBC. We did some videos on FX Guide TV about this. And these changes are pretty extensive enough that we've partnered with Autodesk and we're doing some getting started videos that are kind of designed if you're a Flame person and you want to get up to speed on these 20th anniversary edition of the software. You can head over to fxphd.com, our sister training site, /flametraining, and you'll see the first batch of those, depending on when you're listening to this. I think there's four or five of them up now. There's going to be a total of 10 of those. And the first ones I've watched, and John goes through quite a bit of detail, kind of overview of the UI and talking about the timeline and conforming. And there's a lot to get used to. And so I think these videos are really going to help people get jump started. So let's jump in now to the interview with John Montgomery talking to Philippe Soiro about these new software releases from Autodesk.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us, and congratulations on quite a momentous release, this 20th anniversary edition of Flame.
Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Before we dive into detail about the release, well, why don't you just touch base, give us an idea of the overview and what your goals were accomplishing in modifying the workflow within the application?
I think there's been a number of components that pushed us to actually envision such a drastic workflow change. I think one of them is that for a very long time, we've actually really been playing with the idea of bringing timeline-centric or story-centric type of creative environments within Flame. And of course, this is something that was to a certain extent in Smoke, most definitely in Luster for grading. But Flame was kind of missing it. So one component actually that was driving us is that we were seeing the future of finishing actually really relying on story-centric creative processes. And so that was one goal here. So we wanted to modify the Flame workflow so that it could actually really have a fully integrated timeline. But I don't think we should pitch it as a merge between Flame and Smoke, because I think that the result of what we did certainly goes beyond that and actually to some extent really redefines the creative flow within the application, because we've decided to effectively bring batch, the desktop, and the timeline as equal citizens within the creative environment, and actually that changes a lot. I think the workflow of the application, and also how you simply deal with flow graph versus clips versus timelines in a very equal fashion in the same environment. So that's one component. Mm-hmm. There was another component also, is that we also wanted to streamline, I guess, is a good word. Streamline a lot of the processes that happen on a daily basis, and were quite frankly, very convoluted in the application. We had to take a step back and look at how some things would scale, and why it has been so difficult in the past just to do something that's been requested by users for ages, like multiple clip export, and I think a lot had to do with all of these very convoluted workflows that simply were built on top of each other across the last 20 years. So we had to take a step back and said, okay, I mean, this is not really the way of moving forward, and we can't really build anything that's future-proof, continue to deal with a whole bunch of things, nest genius components of the application. And of course, you know, users may argue that, well, no, it worked fine. I would argue back that this is because most people got so used to doing really weird things, you know, that they don't think twice about it. But, you know, I think objectively we had serious workflow issues with certain types of tasks. And of course, I/O is a big component of that. Archiving, wire, import, export, publish, but also things like conform, for example, that we also wanted to revisit, because I think they were quite an epitome of things that requested that you would go in all sorts of different modules to do something without any feedback.
That's interesting you bring that up, because that was one of the highlights of the release I was going to mention, was conform. I mean, it's a radical redesign. Can you talk about some of the improvements in that module?
Well,
it's a new module, actually.
It's a new module and an application that right now, you know, also considers conform as a very important task of your everyday workflow, at least in a finishing application. And so, yes, I think for us, the goal was definitely to move away from the model that we had where, you know, in the, you know, historically, conform was all EDL based, and then gradually file based conforming came up. All of that were handled in a very different way workflow wise. So our intention was to bring everything into, I guess, a single UI that could present you with all the different elements that are required to make decisions and also to troubleshoot a conform, which is something that happens actually every time you do a conform, let's face it. And so, yes, so the goal for us was really to bring things so that you could actually see the timeline, the editorial context, the list of events that you were trying to link, and the footage that is susceptible to link to these events with potential candidates, and actually surface to the user a number of data points that could assist him in actually selecting the right source to connect to an event whenever there was a complex, let's put it that way. So that makes up for a much more streamlined and conform environment. And I think one of the rationale for us to make that effort was also to look towards the future. In the future, I think there are components of the conform workflow that we still need to improve, and things like reconforming, iterative conforming, if you like, are things that definitely require a UI placeholder to deal with such situations. And so that's one of the reasons why we decided to promote conform to its own UI, if you like.
Another big aspect, I think another really nice change, is the first implementation of a really strong color managed workflow. Frankly, I think its implementation is really well thought out in comparison to so many other apps out there. I mean, I think that's a significant change in the software as well.
Well, I think, you know, the credit should most definitely go to Doug Walker, our color scientist. And so he's been, obviously he's been the brains behind this, and it's been, you know, an effort that's been very long to bring to fruition, simply also because, you know, these are topics that are kind of difficult sometimes to prioritize and fit in, even though effectively, you know, they affect everybody on almost on a daily basis. So yes, I think that Doug Walker has managed to come up actually with a color management engine that is, I mean, state of the art at this point, fully compatible also with the work that's being done by the Academy. It's XML based, and it introduces actually, you know, a new set of color transforms, a new format of color transforms that is capable of dealing with most of the situations that people would expect, you know, dealing with output devices, display devices, different cameras, different types of image data sets, and connecting them together into a wide gamut working space, if this is what you want to do. So yes, I think it's a very important step forward. That being said, I do think that we still have a lot of work to do to make all of these concepts, which, you know, let's face it, they're very harsh to understand for anybody who is who doesn't know anything about color science. It's, right. you know, very stuff. And I think we still have a lot of work to do to make it really simple inside of an application like Flame. But nonetheless, I think it's a very important step forward.
Yeah, I want to just put a quick plug in for Mike did an article in August of last year called The Art of Digital Color, which is a really great article talking about this. And well, Flame's in there in the previous setup, of course, it was done a year ago, but does a really nice explanation of ACES and scene-referred color workflow. So just want to give people who are listening, check that out, do a search for Art of Digital Color on our site.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... I mean, it really is an exciting release. I mean, it's an amusing the startup screen. The logo is back to the old school Flame logo, which is kind of a nice touch in the 20th anniversary edition. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to have been using it for the last couple of weeks. And while there really is so much great stuff, and I love the new workflow. When I go back to the previous version of software, I do find some things in, you know, the 2012 release. I find myself missing stuff in the new release, which I think is a great sign.
Oh, yes, that is indeed an encouraging sign. Yes,
yeah, I like that. But at the same time, I feel that the software really has quite a few rough edges in it. From my feeling, it's like the gestation period, I guess, wasn't long enough or not enough time in beta. And, you know, with all the workflow changes that have been made, it seems really critical to have something that's, you know, quite solid in the software. I mean, perception-wise, I mean, was this kind of gotten out in a quick manner too quickly?
You know, it's a tough subject. You're asking this to a designer, designers never think that anything is really quite ready. You know, this project has been an ongoing thing for us. And, you know, even though, you know, it may be flagged as the 20th anniversary release, it's been something that we have been working on for over 3 years, really. If we think about, you know, like the first design concepts that we discussed internally, and at the time we called it entirely differently. We used to refer to the edit desk desktop merge, and maybe you've heard about that actually in some very early alpha sessions and things like that. So it's been something that's been very long in the making, and I think we've reached a point where, as you point out, I think the workflow changes are quite significant. And in a project of this magnitude, you're right. I mean, there are things that are, I think it's very difficult to avoid for things to be, you know, not left out or things slipping through the cracks. And you're like, what about this? And you're like, oh, yeah. Okay, well, that's a good point. Okay. But I think there comes a time where simply we... Given the magnitude of the changes, I think we need to put it out there, because users should not embark on this release thinking this is just another extension. It is really very much, I think, of a new departure for Flame. I think it's fair to say, you know, and a lot of the workflow concepts that I think need adjustments from existing users. And I think this is something that takes a bit of time, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, I think, to put it out there. And I'm really hoping that people will engage with us actually to make this a very good Flame at the end of the day. I mean, this is a very strong sign also on our side that we're very committed to Flame. And I hope you realize at this point how frustrating I think the past months have been in the wake of the announcement of Smoke on the Mac, and people were thinking that we had dropped Flame, and there was nothing like that in our minds.
Actually, speak to that, because you do read a lot about that on the net, so to speak, or Twitter, that basically this new Flame is basically taking all the stuff that you're doing on Smoke on Mac. But the reality is these were very much developed in tandem internally.
Yes. Yeah, they are developed in tandem for sure, and you know, it's true. I think even from a design perspective, it didn't make any sense for us to, you know, if we were doing, let's say, changes to the timeline to make the workflow in the timeline more streamlined, more accessible. Of course, this is something that's very pertinent also for Flame, that does not or did not have a timeline. So some smoke users may resent the fact that we changed the buttons around, but I think ultimately, I mean, it is for the best. The old smoke timeline was simply presenting buttons that you were using once every 4 years with the same importance that buttons that you were using constantly. It didn't make any sense from a workflow perspective. So when we're making such adjustments, of course, we're making them and thinking about both applications simultaneously. When we think about importing and exporting, why would it be different between the two applications? So yes, there was a very strong design effort to define a common core, also based on longer term vision of the applications. And whether it's smoke on the Mac and whether it's Flame, we see that in both spaces, actually having a very tight relationship between editorial data and flow graph data was of paramount importance. And if we didn't have this in both applications, we would essentially shoot ourselves in the foot. But that being said, I think that if you look at Flame and if you look at its workflow, there's some very, very important, actually, I would say very significant differences in terms of workflow, which distinguishes it from smoke on the Mac. And those are very hard to explain, just like it's difficult to explain to somebody who doesn't know it. You know, explain to somebody the value of the desktop for somebody who's never used the desktop. Very tough. But if we took away the desktop from Flame, I think we would get a riot from Flame users. But try to explain the value of it. It's very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. I think we are in a similar situation here with Flame, where what we did by bringing batch and the timeline and the desktop in such an intricate connected environment is something that you actually have to see and experience for yourself to understand where it puts you in terms of creative capabilities, in terms of very circular type of workflow where content creation can precede editorial, but it doesn't conflict with the fact that editorial can drive also your content creation. Those are things I think that are very specific to a finishing product like Flame in the high end, and are not in something like Smoke on the Mac. Yet for us, it made perfect sense for them to have the same timeline. You know, so yes, it's been you know, a bit frustrating, but I mean, those are the rules. I mean, we cannot speak about stuff that we haven't released, and yes, it was frustrating for us to look at, you know, kind of like the disenchantment on the of existing users who really thought that we were dumping Flame, which is definitely not the case. Quite the contrary, actually.
Yeah, I think that's one of the very positive things about the release from my standpoint is that, you know, you can see that you're investing a tremendous amount of effort and money, frankly, in the development of the product. We talked about it, I think, in FX Guy TV interview before IBC as well. And I do think that's a very positive thing about this release, as it does show that commitment. Under the hood, I think one of my biggest concerns about the release that gives me apprehension is removing the old school import and export functionality, and effectively, correct me if I'm wrong, replacing it with one of my least favorite aspects of the software, which is Gateway, which I've found reliability wise in the past has been certainly lacking. First of all, speak to the reasons for getting rid of the previous, what I call the old school import export functionality.
Okay, well, you know, the reason for getting rid of it is that, you know, in the process of such a redesign, we actually have to identify what I could call, I think, dead ends in terms of code and the legacy import and export. As much as people like them, were dead ends. They did not allow us to deploy codecs easily. And I know that people, you know, would argue that we're never fast enough to support new codecs. But, you know, the fact that we moved away from integrated components directly into the application, but instead, you know, chose to go the way of components that are abstracted from the application also allowed us to support codecs simultaneously between all of our applications. And that included Lustre, which is a totally different code base from Flame and Smoke. The legacy import and export were simply not scalable to provide us with that sort of flexibility. It just did not It wasn't worth us investing in any of this. And I'd like to point out, by the way, that it's not only the legacy import and export, but it's the legacy wire, the legacy archiving. Everything is actually changed now. Mm-hmm. So you no longer have that, you no longer have, you know, the way that you perform wire transfers between networked workstations is different in this release than it was in the previous release. The same would apply, I think, to archive. And actually, that is the fundamental reason why we did away with some of these legacy modules. Let's put it that way. And there are other examples, even in the creative realm, like the keyer.
Yeah, we'll come to that.
I'm sure. But so the I think for us the goal here was to essentially streamline everything into a workflow that was consistent. Did not use bits and codes that were heterogeneous. It didn't make any sense for us for publish to be an entirely different type of code, and publish is in a different area of the software. It's not where export is yet. It is an export. Why is that the case? I mean, really, just take a step back. It didn't make any sense.
Right. But I would say the one of the reasons that we love the import and export as artists is that it was bulletproof and it worked. And that's why so many of us gravitated to using that, because we try and go to gateway. I mean, I'm just looking at Smoke News, the last message this morning, the subject is wiretap crashing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what has been done to make that more stable and to make sure that we can get software in and out of the software reliably? Because that, I mean, that's always been one of the great things about Flame. I mean, everyone would come to us to lay stuff off and work with stuff because we knew we could efficiently get it on and off the system.
Listen, John, your point is taken. And the only thing that I can say is that we're very committed to actually making this work and achieve the robustness that everybody would expect on a box like Flame. That's as much as I can say. The other thing that I can say also is that for us, there's no turning back. At some point we have to move on and things have to just work the way people would expect. I think ultimately if we actually manage to get the stability that everybody's expecting, the new workflow that you have in the Media Hub far surpasses anything that we had before. In terms of flexibility, in terms of how information is surfaced to the user, in terms of browsing experience, it has nothing to do with what you had in the old import or the old export for that matter. So yes, I think there's no turning back for us. And the only thing that I can say is that this simply has to work. And every time there will be instances of things not working, we will hunt them down and make sure that they work. That's as much as I can say.
One of the other things about Gateway is not just the stability of it, but actually the performance. Because when you're looking at clips and browsing for clips in the file system, it seems you're not really looking at like a view in the Finder on the OS on Mac or a directory window in Linux or something like that. And it can actually be quite painful performance-wise when you scan directories with a large number of files. I mean, really painful. I mean, we're talking thousands of files, but that's something you used to really easily be able to do with the import module. I mean, I hope you guys are looking at that as a place to improve performance.
Yes, very much so. I think it's part of the feedback also that came out of beta, and yes, so we understand that we have a performance issue on directories that have large amounts of image files in them, yes, it's most definitely on our plan to on our radar to improve this as soon as possible. I think that we got caught, I think, in our own intention of doing good, and probably went slightly overboard. We've been very picky about checking the metadata of the image files and checking out for sequence holes or missing images and time code holes and things like that have been slowing down the performance. And so we realized that, again, this is probably a question of, misjudging, I think, the value of the trade-off. So we will definitely look into this as soon as possible to improve.
So basically you're spending a considerable amount of time just checking stuff as opposed to displaying things for the end user. Am I correct?
It is something that definitely contributes to slowing down the process, and so that is definitely something that we are looking into changing to bring in some kind of fast browsing mode also that can be much more easily interrupted, because that's another issue I think that people on the beta brought up. And so those are extremely valid points, and we're definitely planning on addressing them.
What is the thing that ends up taking a long time, say, importing files from the file system? If I'm going to, there's the mode of store local copy is now called store cache or
cache media.
Cache media, sorry. And, you know, for instance, dragging a folder, one of the nice things is you can actually drag and drop folders, and it recreates that folder structure for you automatically in the media library, which is quite cool. But say dropping a folder with, say, you know, 70 clips and XML file. I mean, I did that the other day and it took about 3 minutes to get the UI back. What is happening under the hood during that process that causes that delay? And can that be improved as well?
Yes, most definitely. I think we've been trying to hunt down these instances where background processes are actually lagging the application. But essentially, all the import processes are background tasks that get triggered, and I suspect that, you know, without necessarily being able to say that this is what you're confronted to, I think in our experience we have been confronted to situations where this was lagging the application in an abnormal fashion. So we've been trying to nail out these instances of this actually causing slowdown of importing process, but it has to do primarily with the way that we deal with a variety of background processes simultaneously in the application.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess it is easy to say that, okay, it took me 3 minutes to drag those clips, but had I had to have those as a foreground process, it frankly would have tied up the machine a lot longer, I guess.
That's the thing, is that, you know, it was kind of a surprise to us, you know, when some people were asking for foreground process as an advantage, and it's not really an advantage. I mean, the way that we let you work now is most definitely, it's a lot more flexible than or at least in my opinion, it's a lot more flexible than it was ever before. So
you probably know the answer to that, but mine would be because it works every time. Would be one reason.
Yeah, I understand. But so that is the problem. You see, it's not fundamentally about the background process. It's more a question of, if there is a problem, first of all, I want to know about it, and what can I do to fix it? And there shouldn't be a problem in the first place. I think so. Those are the fundamental issues, as opposed to I want foreground process, which, you know, really doesn't make any sense. When you think about it. So, you know, this may sound like a rhetoric type of answer, but effectively it's not. You know, when people ask for something, we always have to track back to the actual problem, as opposed to the solution that is suggested by a user. And in this particular case, I think that what you're saying is that it's the robustness that is something that is making people very nervous, and so that has to be fixed. And so that's the primary issue, I guess, that you have. And the second thing is that the background process have made people nervous because in the past they've also been failing without reporting any errors to the user, which I think is another problem, and that problem has to be solved, as opposed to, say, every import or every IO task has to happen in the foreground, which, you know, objectively doesn't really make that much sense.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, I think the key thing from our standpoint is that, as I mentioned, we started that discussion, is that file IO is robust. It works every time, and we can rely on it like we always have in Flame. And I think I'm glad to hear that you seem to be keenly aware of that issue.
Very much so.
Right. Well, you mentioned the keyer and as far as module, that's another change. And yeah, I mean, I think the loss of the keyer is the old school keyer is difficult. But let's touch to why you had to remove certain modules first, because I actually think that's actually quite a positive step in what's being done in the software. What were the reasons for getting rid of something like the keyer?
Well, similar reasons to really the import and the export is that, you know, our, first of all, architectural reasons, but actually, in the context of the Kier, it's a slightly different architectural constraint that we had is the legacy Kier or the discrete Kier, whichever way you want to call it, did not support 16-bit float, and it was already something that was causing issues in previous releases, whereby if you initiated, for example, action in 16-bit float, well, you know, the Kier had to be blocked, for example, because it didn't support it. And even though all of these tools may look like very similar, whether you look at it, you know, whether you look at the modular key or whether you look at the discrete key, or, you know, things from a UI perspective seem, you know, similar, the zooming functionality, the stuff like that. It was actually a very different type of code. And in this particular release, we're introducing an entirely different rendering pipeline inside of Batch that systematically promotes everything to 16-bit float. So you can imagine that in this context, you know, any node that actually doesn't understand anything about 16-bit float becomes really a persona non grata. So it was again for the greater good, because I think ultimately this architectural change is actually a great benefit to the application, both in the short term and in the longer term. We had to get rid of the old keyer. Now, I want to point out one thing, though, perhaps because, you know, like legacy setups that use the discrete keyer will still reload with the discrete keyer. And we've actually left at a project level, we left the ability for users to launch the application using the classic engine. And if you use the classic engine and load a legacy setup that uses the discrete keyer, all the discrete keyers will load properly and they will render properly. So if it's just a question of re-rendering something or modifying an old setup, there is definitely a path to do that. But moving forward, we simply do not see a tool like the discrete keyer actually as a viable tool. The one last thing that I want to point out is that at the same time, you know, we understand that one of the reasons why people like the discrete keyer, it is because of its streamlined interface that kind of groups all of the different components in a fixed pipeline, and you kind of have everything that's there that you need to do, you know, a typical key. So that we recognize very much. And so, you know, in the retirement type of for the keyer, we had actually really studied ways of actually repackaging the tools that are still there, whether in the modular queue or directly in Batch for that matter, into a super tool that could replace the keyer to address the ease of use type of concern. It so happened that it just didn't fit into the release schedule. But this is something that, you know, we still have on our radar. And I just wanted people to know that that this concern of ease of use is something that we haven't forgotten, and we will most definitely try to bring back something that will address that, and hopefully also in a way that is more generically beneficial to the application than just the keyer, for that matter. So this is something that's on our radar, and then in the interim, as I said, anyone reloading old setups can actually load old setups, and they will restore the old keyer nodes in that setup. So
yeah, that would be improved. I mean, you're right. The thing about the keyer that's nice is it is kind of almost a utility tool. You can quickly do masks. You can actually use as a comparison tool. You can easily switch between different types of keys to see what looks nice and what works. To actually do that quite a bit when working.
Understood. Yes, and that's very well understood. To the point of comparison, it's also sometimes we sometimes have to make these hard calls for comparison. For example, I still think that it's really a shame that Flame doesn't actually have a proper comparison tool, and that people have to resort to the difference mat to do that, or the keyer essentially right. Speaks to the problem. So the real problem is that we don't actually have an appropriate comparison tool inside of the application. And so from a design standpoint, this is how we should address the problem, as opposed to, it was so great to do in a difference mat is so great to do comparison. Yeah, but it wasn't meant to be used to do that in the first place. So anyway,
that's understood. But we did lose the comparison tool called the Keyer. But it's good, really good news to hear that that's on your radar and improving and getting a workflow that seems similar and if not better, and fits into the pipeline. Talk about some of the challenges also. And one thing that I've noticed on the desktop is some rough edges just in, it seems, performance. I mean, as I mentioned, going back to 2012, there's lots of stuff that I actually missed on the desktop. There's quite a bit more that you can actually do directly on the desktop, especially with multi-select capability and applying reformats or dealing with media or splicing things on the desktop. It's really nice, but it feels a bit sluggish to me compared to the previous Flame desktop. I mean, how are you feeling about the performance in that? I mean, I hope you're seeing that as well and can hopefully address some of that.
So, I mean, you know what, we're most definitely listening. The challenge with the desktop, it's effectively an entirely new desktop. It has obviously some visual common points with the old desktop, so it feels familiar, but effectively under the hood, it's a completely different beast altogether. And it's one that does actually a lot more than the old desktop. As you point out, I mean, we have ubiquitous right-clicking, direct access to certain tools like reformat and, you know, explicit selection schemes, multi-selection, but also things like sending clips to the broadcast from the desktop, things that were not supported before. So selecting a clip, spontaneously send it to the desktop. You know, also soft effects also can actually be pre-visualized directly in the reels, which again was not supported by the desktop. So we've actually, through the beta, it's something that we realized, you know, even though I think technically probably you could argue that the desktop is faster than it was, it's doing so much more.
Right, understand.
It's doing so much more that the performance hit turns out to be probably, you know, not an appropriate trade-off. So we certainly listened to that feedback, and what we're looking at is we're investigating, I think, other trade-off scenarios to get back some of that snappiness that, you know, we agree, I think, is essential to the desktop. I think it's one of the great values of the desktop. It's this very interactive ideation space. It has to respond to the user. And if people feel that they lost that, then it's something that we need to fix.
I think that's a good point, because I mean, you can actually do more things in the desktop and there is more functionality, but sometimes it just does come down to perception of when you're just simply interacting and moving, you have a bit of hesitation or sluggishness compared to the old software that does impact our perception as artists and performance in the desktop in general.
And that's well understood, and we will have to address that. As with every, you know, single optimization effort, you know when you start it, you don't necessarily know when you end it. To get some visible results. So, but again, as I said, we are most definitely investigating some other trade-off scenarios that could potentially be optional. You know, deactivating certain functionality of the desktop, so that, you know, we at least maintain this feeling of snappiness that the desktop has historically always had. And as you point out, I think it's not across the board. It's in some instances, you know, that all of a sudden you feel that there is, you know, like some stickiness. So we acknowledge that, and this is something that will need to be addressed. I think ultimately the new desktop, though, is, from my perspective, is actually quite exciting. The fact that we lifted some of the restrictions, like, you know, infinite reels and being able to toggle visibility rules in the desktop, and even, you know, multiple selection is something cool. And the contextual menus also, I think, make it, you know, a very interesting beast. The other thing that I want to point out is it's a very intimate connection to the timeline, which effectively is just acts as another view of any clip that you select in the desktop. So as I said, it is really fundamentally a very different thing than it was before. But the feedback is understood, and we will act upon it.
And I'd also think, though, and it leads to my feeling of it, the needing a bit more gestation, being in beta longer before the actual release. I also find that there are just some things right now in this initial release that are kind of and disturbing or unexpected when you're working. There's some bugs like, you know, clips get placed off screen and you can't see them. You generate a clip. I think that also leads to the perception of being a bit lost in the new desktop in the initial release.
I'm curious, in this, what's the,
in order to address some of these kind of functionality things that we kind of dealt with, what's the kind of release schedule plan development cycle in the coming months? I mean, hopefully, and it, you know, obviously NAB won't be the next release, I would imagine.
No, it won't. Actually, no. I can clearly say that it won't. I think we, you know, as I said, I think we're committed to addressing the most pressing issues and also I think the beta served a very interesting for us. You know, it's an essential thing whereby sometimes you underestimate, let's say, the level of adoption of a feature in the desktop. So things came up like, we lost the shuttle, the ability to shuttle within a reel in the desktop. And we're like, oh yeah, we forgot about that one. I mean, or like the last rendered clip. I mean, all these little things, all of these little points of details kind of slip through the cracks and we are definitely planning on addressing them and in update releases, whether you want to call them service packs or whatever. I don't really know what the terminology officially is going to be because effectively those are update releases that will have new functionality built into them. So I think it makes them something more than a service pack, but I can't really speak to the official terminology, but yes, you can expect us to deliver update releases before NAB for sure. Absolutely.
So you don't have a timetable per se that you can talk about in getting.
Okay. Well, I think that I will risk myself at saying that we will, you know, it is, it, it's, I think we can, I'm hoping that we will get probably a first update release before the end of this new quarter. I think December looks like a plausible window.
Yeah, and the reason I mention that is because philosophically, I think a good approach with this release, because it is, frankly, such a major workflow release first and foremost. And again, I'm really positive as the testers on beta have been about the new workflow in general terms. I mean, really excited about how easy it is to get back and forth. But because there are these rough edges and bugs, frankly, in the software, I mean, I kind of feel that it's best idea for people who are on subscription to kind of install this alongside the current release, get up to speed with it, because it is going to take some time to get up to speed in it. I mean, I've been using it probably as much as anyone in this beta process. And I was asking some questions last night as I'm recording tutorials about certain things. I mean, philosophically, what approach do you think people should take?
Well, I think what you described, the scenario that you described, I think is an ideal situation. The worst that could happen to us is if, you know, somebody has the really bad idea of installing this version over a weekend and the operators come in on Monday and resume their work on a project. That is not going to be a pleasant experience because there, as you point out, there are some important workflow changes and, you know, paradigm shifts or whichever way you want to call it. And I think, these take a little bit of time. There's so, a scenario whereby you can actually afford to install both versions alongside, the new version alongside the previous version is probably an ideal learning type of situation, and most definitely the one that I would recommend before you start, you know, heads on working with a new project with this release. You have to get acquainted. Everything, there's a lot of things that had to change, including some hotkeys, just because of the fact that components that were entirely separate in the application now are kind of merged together. And, you know, like batch, the timeline and the desktop, who's right in terms of hotkeys. So we had to make choices and, you know, so just to speak to these, details. So just getting familiar with the feel. And it's interesting. We've had, you know, obviously even, you know, internally, like the testing team had to go through this process. Obviously the beta users had to go through this process. When we showed the release for the first time at IBC, all the application engineers who had to build the demos also had to go through, you know, an extremely intense type of, training course to get up to speed. And and what we've seen is that roughly, you know, it required at least like 2 to 3 weeks for people to feel really comfortable again with it. So yes, I think that, and obviously this, in the case of the application engineers, they were kind of banging on it on, you know, like 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think that obviously a scenario where you can get acquainted with the new workflow, and let us know how you feel about it. Actually, you know, I think this is something that I would consider to be an ideal situation.
What's the best venue for feedback for people who are using the software?
Well, you know, it all depends on what you're prepared to do. I think that, for people who are, committed to let's say install releases as we work on them and provide constructive feedback, outside of just, I can understand that everybody can get frustrated and you just vent, okay? From our perspective, it's understood that it's something that can be, mm-hmm. Satisfying, but it's not very constructive for us. But so if you're willing to install, take the risk of installing things, using them, providing constructive feedback, I would most definitely encourage those people to get on the beta program. It's definitely the most direct connection to us. And hopefully also the most satisfying one for the ones who are engaging with us because we respond. If you cannot have that level of commitment, which I understand, I think that, we continue to read the forums, we continue to read the area, Flame News, all of the different forums. And if you speak to your application engineers on the field, it's also something that is interesting to provide feedback. They will bring it back to us.
Yeah. I just want to vouch for the idea of while beta is a ton of work, it can be very great to actually, get little things that you'd like to see fixed, put into the software, frankly, or at least really by that, I mean, hiding or guiding development, I guess. It is quite rewarding to be able to have an impact on that.
Well, I mean, a lot of the things, little things, annoyances and things that, we alluded to about the desktop were brought back during beta. And, the minute they were, brought up, we evaluate the pertinence of it versus, our workflow intention. Does it go against it or is it something that we clearly omitted or underestimated the value of? And we fix them. We change them as we go. And I think moving forward, also the beta is going to be much more of an ongoing process than it has been in the past, whereby essentially, it's never really going to close, which hasn't necessarily been the case in the past, where, when we would move from one release to the next, the beta forum would close until it would reopen, until we're ready to go for the next beta. So the intention is to have, a much more continuous process with beta. And again, as I said, for people who are willing to engage with us and make that level of commitment, and I understand it can be tricky for a lot of people, especially like the bigger facilities, it's definitely the best way of engaging with us. And for the rest, I think forums and talking to your to the sales teams, to the application engineers are all also valid ways of actually telling us how you feel.
Well, it really is an exciting release. And while I certainly feel that, the software probably went out the door, in my opinion, a bit too soon with some of the things in it, I think, again, if people approach the software from the standpoint of, like you say, installing alongside the current release, get up to speed, I'm confident that you guys are going to actually come through in what you say. And that's actually really work hard to squash first some of those bugs, and number two, smooth out some of the workflow issues that we're currently running into the software.
Yes, and I, the thing that I hope is that people will embrace those changes. They will fight their own frustration of having to learn something new. I think ultimately, I mean, it is for the best. But you've been through this process, so I guess you can also speak to it. And yes, I think it's a very positive thing for Flame. And we invested a lot of time and a lot of thought into building this, a lot more than you would invest in something that's a dead application. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think so. And I think one of the keys in is approaching it with an open mind from the start. Try out the stuff, see if it works for you. Don't immediately go, oh my God, I have to do that with a contextual menu click. instead of having a dedicated hotkey or button for that. And you know, spend some time with it before, you know, just saying, I want everything back the way it was before, because it does take some time to get up to speed with the software, I will say.
You know, I think actually I was just thinking that, you know, most of the things that you have in contextual menus have actually, you know, shortcuts associated to them.
Yes.
So you can look at it also as a way of discovering those shortcuts. And, you know, some people have been arguing that contextual menus have nothing to do in an application that's high end. And really, I just strongly disagree with that kind of statement. I mean, it's first of all, we also made contextual menus that are quite big in the interface, so that they're easier to use with a pen and tablet, which we think continues to be the primary, you know, controlling device for an application like Flame. But also effectively, you know, if they stop you from navigating to an entirely different area, losing the context of what you're doing to perform an operation, then it makes it faster. And that's a good thing for an application like Flame. So yes, don't reject concepts simply because you've seen them in the desktop application. We've been very careful, I think, in making these choices and at least as much as possible, try to respect, I think, what made Flame strong, a strong application in the past.
Well, again, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it to get us caught up to date, as well as answer some questions about things in the release. Again, I think it's a very positive release. And while it is buggy and a first release and with rough edges, I think it really does speak well to the future for the software.
Well, thank you, John.
But once again, I'd like to thank Philippe for taking time to sit and talk to us and answer our questions. And, you know, you can tell by John's passion about the product. You know, sometimes we can be a little tough on them in these interviews because we just all love this software so much and use it so often and, you know, grew up on it. So it's kind of I think that's why you'll see us kind of holding their feet to the fire, as you will. But I think you can see the respect. And I know I'm personally looking really forward to getting the new release installed. And also the smoke on the Mac is pretty remarkable. I've been playing with that quite a bit lately, and the new preview release that's out. And, you know, having all that tool set available to me on my laptop for such a personally affordable price, pretty exciting. And once again, I hope you'll check out those videos, the training videos that are free over on fxphd.com/flametraining. I think you'll find those very helpful in transitioning to using the new software, or even if you just want to check out what Autodesk has been up to and kind of the new things that they've been doing. So check that out. Before I close out, I'd like to just take an opportunity to thank our FX Insider members. FX Insider was kind of born from people coming to us and saying, we'd like to help with the site. We realize you don't do a lot of advertising, and so they support the site through contributions. As a thanks for those donations, made as part of the FX Insider program, we give them exclusive access to additional content. Things like member-only articles, additional effects breakdowns, and more. High-resolution images, for example. Details are at fxguide.com, and then click the FX Insider tab. In addition to this FX podcast, we do two other regular audio podcasts. The first one is the VFX Show, which reviews visual effects and current releases, as well as classic films. The RC podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. And if you enjoyed this podcast, we'd also recommend our HD video podcast, FX Guide TV. All of those are available at fxguide.com. And then our sister site, as I mentioned earlier, fxphd.com, offers extensive, affordable, online visual effects training, the best in the business. So thanks for my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery. This is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.